Hello and welcome to episode 47 of There Is No Offseason, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. I am your host, Ben Carsley, and I am joined by BP's Fantasy Manager and a recent guest of the Effectively Wild podcast, Brett Sayer, and my fellow authors, a recent guest of the Effectively Wild podcast, Mauricio Rubio, and a recent guest of the Effectively Wild podcast, Craig Goldstein. Good evening, guys. Say hi to everyone and tell them where they can find you on the interwebs. And Brett, we'll start with you.
You can find me at baseballperspectus.com and thedynastyguru.com and on the tweet box at dynastyguru. Mal?
You can find me at Baseball Prospectus. You can also find me at BP Wrigleyville once a week. And you can find me on Twitter at mrubio52. Craig?
You can find me at Baseball Prospectus, at the Dynasty Guru, Fox Sports MLB, as a recent guest on the Effectively Wild podcast, and on Twitter, at CD Goldstein. That's CD as in classic dude, Goldstein. Ben?
Excellent. You can also find me at Baseball Prospectus. You can find me at the Dynasty Guru. You can find me at BP Boston, and you can sporadically find me on the Effectively Wild podcast, on which I was also on. You can find me at Ben Carsley on Twitter, this podcast on Twitter via the aptly named at Tino Podcast handle, and you can ask us questions and talk to us about your feelings by emailing us at tinopodcast@gmail.com. So hello, everyone. It's not been a very long time since we last spoke, because the time that we last spoke was yesterday when we were on the Effectively Wild podcast together, which is also a podcast from Baseball Prospectus, but not a podcast that always focuses solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. So we branched out a little bit, but I'm really glad that we got to give Ben and Sam the Tino bump. I think this will be good for them, and I definitely see where our name value could, you know, open a few people's eyes into just what they're all about. So that was good on us. We've done our good deed for the week.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of promise over there.
Well, I don't know if I would say that, but I'm glad we did what we could.
Yeah. We tried.
The way Ben read his outro was awfully rehearsed and professional, so I'm just not about that life.
Yeah. It was weird having so many Bens.
Yeah, there were entirely too many Bens.
It was also weird having an organized Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. Well, that went well for me. Okay, so today we are going to talk about a U25 Dynasty ranking for the NL East. For those of you who have been listening to Tino for a while now, you will recognize this series from when Craig and I did it last year. And even though basically everyone on this podcast no longer solely contributes to the fantasy team any longer, Craig and I have decided to keep Dynasty Dynamics going. And our first real sort of 2015 series will be this U25 look.
For the people, we should point out.
Totally, totally for the people. Yeah, no.
That's not at all for you and I alone, but for the people.
No, and certainly not at all for Brett.
No.
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 Who?
I don't even remember. Okay, so that's what we're going to do after the questions. We're also going to talk about another topic that Brett has that I don't remember, so you can tell we put a lot of research into that. But first, we'll start with the aforementioned questions, and the first one is from Cody. Cody says, Benjamin, when you read this on the podcast, Justified will be no more. What a bleak world you must live in. My question relates to shallower keeper leagues. 12-team, 10 keepers per team league. My team is contending again after an ill-advised Astro-style teardown and rebuild. The good news is I have 10 keepers who are consensus top 80. As I drafted, I focused mainly on 2015. My question is, in this case, should my draft and free agent moves basically be redraft-type moves without considering the keeper potential, except for not gutting my core keeper roster? Isn't trade currency the primary value you derive from young players? Cheers, Cody. First of all, yes, it is an absolute tragedy that Justified will be ending, although I will say that it's going out on quite a high note. But seeing as no one else watches Justified, we won't elaborate on that. And instead, Craig, I will let you address the part of this question that pertains to our podcast from Baseball Prospectus that focuses solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats.
Yeah, well, I would say first and foremost that it's not a tragedy, but that it's actually justified. Thank you. Thank you. Now, to answer the question, I would say that, I mean, he mainly has the point in that, you know, it drafting for your team once you have your keepers set is a reasonable thing to do, and maximizing your chances for the present season is a good plan. I would also just say that, you know, he identifies that the primary value from younger players is trade currency, and so, you know, getting younger players who could be keepers and then flipping them for more value mid-season is a viable strategy too. So I think it's something that I wouldn't completely eschew, you know, long-term value or keeper value in a draft or in free agency. I would be trying to target these guys because in the end, you know, it might be that you pick up someone who ends up being your eighth keeper and makes your keepers stronger and lets you flip someone else down the line. So that's kind of how I see it. Brett, what do you think?
I think the important thing to note here is that it's not none of these things are mutually exclusive. You can take essentially scare quote redraft type players and still have one or two of them end up being quality keepers for you in the end. It's not it's a shallow league. It's 120 keepers total. So yeah, I would more or less be concentrating entirely on now production with a couple of higher upside players sprinkled in so that you do have a trade chip or two in the middle of the season in case teams are looking for to throw in the towel and take on a younger player with some upside. Mal?
No, yeah, I mean, it's you know, you definitely want to skew towards now. You guys have kind of wrapped that one nice and neat, I think. Ben, do you have anything to say to the contrary?
No, I will just say that for Justified listeners, Craig is absolutely the Boyd Crowder to my Raylan Givens in that I am totally consumed by my hatred for him.
I do not get that at all.
Which one's Wynn Duffy?
Oh, you are kind of Wynn Duffy, because he's douchey but competent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on. Our second question of the week is not the good question, but it's very indicative of many other not the good questions that we received. And it's sort of natural this time of year, so I won't be too hard on Nick. But Nick asks, "Hello, friends. I know it's early, but anyone you guys are worried about so far? Anyone you'd be looking to buy low on based on poor results? Thanks, Nick." Mao, this is on a tee for you.
I mean, I'm worried about Henderson Alvarez because his arm is dead, apparently. And Ruznia Castillo because he's going to the DL. But, I mean, in terms of, like, early season performance, I'm not really worried about anyone per se. And if anybody's going to really start to push the panic button on, say, someone like John Lester or Clayton Kershaw because they've, you know, haven't lived up to expectations in Kershaw's case or have just completely imploded in Lester's case over two starts, you know, I'm absolutely going to buy early on those, but I just don't think that those guys are going to be available in most of the leagues that I play in. Because I think that for the most part, the owners that are in the leagues that I'm in happen to you know, really understand that this is a really long season. We still have about 155 games left to go. So it's you know, for me, I'm not, you know, the early season performance stuff. I mean, a lot of its variance. I mean, it would have to be an extraordinarily extreme thing that's backed up with all sorts of scouting reports, you know, behind it for me to start getting worried about early season stuff. But I mean, does anybody think differently?
I guess if throws to first are a category in your league, and I wouldn't put it past some of you fucking mongrels, then yeah, sure, you can sell high on Lester, or sell low on Lester, rather. But no, there's nothing to see here.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Mao said about Henderson Alvarez was, I mean, he said it a little jokingly, but basically injured players are really all that you need to talk about at this point, right?
Yeah, injury. Yeah. Like if you want to go after an injury guy, like that's it. Sorry, go ahead, Brett.
I was just going to say, I mean, there's really not much of a list or anything of guys that I'm that worried about. There may be a small list of guys who I'd be hesitant to buy low on at the moment. Really, that list might just consist of Matt Latos. But other than that, I mean, there's really not. There really has to be something noticeable going on to make a week or a week and a half change your opinion too much on a player. And you know, it hasn't even done much with Latos. I still think he'll be okay. But that just doesn't seem like something I want to be a part of right now.
All right, moving on. And I will just say that this question will also apply next week. So there's no need to email us between now and our next podcast and ask us if our feelings have changed. They will have not changed.
Guess just to head that off, at what point do you start caring?
Halfway through May 4th.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I was about to say okay. Like middle of May, but yeah, around there.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'd probably say even a little later to me, but that's probably when I'd start getting worried. But I don't think I'd be moving anyone. I'd probably give it like close to 2 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, my default answer to this is June 1st.
I was being shitty. No, that's
it's hard to separate then.
There's really no intention for anyone to have to separate it. It's sort of the point. All right, we'll move on to our last real question, which is from a Ben. A lot of Bens in my life on podcasts lately, just quite frankly not a fan. And this Ben says, "Hello, guys, whining about getting bad questions, good day. In addition to the circus that is the Tino Listeners League, I'm in a 16-team Dynasty League. I did a little rebuilding and got 5 first-round picks for next year's draft. I've heard that this draft is relatively weak and or pitcher-heavy, when kids aren't drunkenly climbing cranes. So with that in mind, what do you suggest I do with these picks? 4 of them are to likely playoff teams, so in the 8 to 16 range. Given the lack of strength of this draft, is there anything I can do to take advantage of the clowns in my league who do not take part in your magnificent program? Should I package them for a higher pick? I'm unsure of the rough tiers right now. Should I try to acquire other prospects with them? That's risky given the unknown of the upcoming draft. Should I just sit on these picks and try to build with the draft? I think knowing the strength of the upcoming draft is a good thing to know." That's a terrible sentence. "And acting accordingly can be extremely beneficial. In general, what would advice be about this kind of situation? Thanks, Ben Remington." Just an awful email for Ben in terms of he was our guy in delivering us very clean emails, even from his iPhone. And this was a poor, poor showing. But Brett, you start considering fantasy prospects generally, I think, right after puberty. So you're probably best equipped to answer this. What say you?
It's a bad draft class at this point, in terms of not in terms of upside, but in terms of overall value. I mean, we have literally every week a different guy in this draft class ends up with Tommy John, and the number of players that are going to be worth valuing the way we would typically value a draft pick is shrinking by the day. It might be down to 2 or 3 total. I mean, you have guys that are going to be similar to Jeff Hoffman last year, where, you know, if the player was healthy, and you know, take Brady Aiken for example, he's a perfect example. If Brady Aiken is healthy, he's, you know, likely a top 3 pick in dynasty drafts across the board, barring some unforeseen international signings between now and February. But he's now got Tommy John surgery. He's going to drop a little bit. I'm almost tempted to say, I mean, there are some interesting names in the draft, guys that fantasy owners might not be too familiar with, and frankly, guys that fantasy owners might underrate slightly because they don't really project to be big fantasy guys. But it's really just the guy at the top that is going to that's gonna drive this. So if you're looking to trade up, I would look up to trade to the number one spot, or else I would kind of ease off and kind of take the multitude of picks and see who falls based on the weirdness of this draft. And Brendan Rodgers is the guy. Barring something strange, I think he's going to be the number one pick in the draft. He's an offensive shortstop. He's excellent, and he's exactly the kind of guy that you want to take with a top pick in a dynasty draft. Beyond that, it's a mess. Craig, do you have any thoughts on this?
No, not really. I'm just going to move on. I'm just going to try and be brief. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, no matter which way you play this, that's the draft, so you're fine.
Also,
glad we got it in one podcast.
Yeah.
And as you probably well know, Ben, just stay away from Puck and Kirby Snead. Just don't do it. Terrible decision making.
What? Did I miss something?
Those are the two kids who drunkenly climbed cranes and got arrested for it. AJ Puck and Kirby Snead. That's what that was a good reference, Remington. Very good reference.
Why'd you address that to me? Well, Puck and Snead also sounds like it could be like a law firm on a TNT show, so I really had no idea where you were going with that.
Yeah. Well, his name's Ben Remington, right? I mean, you know.
But I also...
other Ben. See, this is why there can't be more than one Ben. I'm totally flabbergasted.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I thought you were talking to Carsley, and it was very confusing.
Oh, my bad.
I just really quickly, I mean, I would package picks in this particular draft because, like, he says it's like, not great, but, like, people are coming out and being like, this draft is awful. So, I don't know. There's still time for guys to pop up a little bit, but I don't know. It's something I would package picks in this particular draft to move up and try and get someone better, but that's me.
Yeah, it's not a I don't think it's an awful draft. I don't think it's a
I agree. I would agree with you. I don't think it is awful, but I have heard multiple people say this is a really bad draft.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I agree with them, but there are also, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. There are people with that in mind.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've heard that as well. I think there are some interesting players from a fantasy perspective that I think are because of the lack of bulk of higher end guys in this draft. I think there are going to be more fantasy types taken in the top 10 to 12 picks than you would generally see guys that very, very bat first guys and players who are may not even be first rounders in the actual draft, but people who profile better in roto leagues.
Yep, that's fair.
All right. It's still amazing to me that we've started to get draft questions this early in the year, but to each his own. So finally, we'll go on to our last question, which is from friend of the podcast, Tyler. He, on Twitter, said, a guy in one of my leagues spent all 100 fab on Hector Oliveira. Should he have traded for more money and spent more fab? Brett, I know you love Oliveira. Usually I'd go here, but I have nothing to say. So what say you? How maybe give up Mike Trout for someone else's entire fab bid and then spend that on Oliveira just in case he's the next Trout?
Sure. Sure. He's only 6 years older than Trout.
Right, so you can't definitively say he's not.
I can't. I can't. Just like I can't definitively say that he has a healthy UCL.
Yep.
Wow.
He's Oliveira is an exciting player. I really think he can hit. I think barring that injury, which may be true. I think he'll be in the majors by around mid to late June, hopefully. You hope his visa stuff and his contract stuff will get nailed down in the next month or so, and he'll get about 4 to 6 weeks of at bats in the minors to ramp up. And I think the Dodgers will find a spot for him, whether it's playing over Uribe, whether it's kind of bouncing around playing different spots.
Whoa, playing and, over Uribe. Whoa, hold on.
Yep.
You can't cast aside my guy just like that, can you? I mean, I guess my honest question here is that what do you think the upside on Olivera is? Like if you know things really work out and he comes over and he's a player that you think he can be, what does that guy look like?
I think it looks like a 300 hitter with 15 to 20 homer power at either second or third base.
I think he could see time in the outfield too. I think especially by the time he's with the team. They might want to get him some at bats in center field when they sit Jock Peterson versus a tough lefty.
Right. So, you know, you think basically that Olivera also sees time in the outfield. So, like, you know, how's that playing situation? How do you think that playing time situation is going to work out, correct? Because that's kind of a lot of outfielders that they have going on out there.
I mean, it is, but it's also a lot of people who haven't played necessarily a full MLB season in a while. Ethier doesn't play that much. Crawford usually gets hurt. Olivera hasn't played in he didn't play in 2013 and played 90 games in 2014. So he's not going to play every day anyway, I don't think. If they want him to be kind of at full strength throughout, I think he's going to need frequent off days. So, you know, Uribe can sit a few days. I don't know. I think having a lot of talent, you know, that can move around at the major league level is a problem that solves itself just because, you know, you rest guys all the time. Uribe doesn't need to play against righties necessarily. He's not that great right on right. And his defense is very good, but, he's also, I think he's, what, 35? You know, he probably benefits from an off day every now and then. And I could see Alexander Guerrero getting moved, especially if he hits well in this little time period where Uribe is hurt and he's in the lineup every day. So, they've obviously shown a willingness to be creative, and I think the situation changes drastically, potentially by August 1st.
That was competent. Yeah,
I was not expecting a real answer to this question. I'm impressed by your resolve.
Okay. I almost died, but just by an inability to breathe correctly, but that's okay.
Well, you know, we're all limited by certain things. I do think we owe the good listeners of Tino a brief apology for not finding a way to work Enya into our Effectively Wild appearance that we each had on Effectively Wild.
I really wanted to use Enya as my breakout player. Couldn't do it, though. Couldn't ball up.
Yeah. When what we really should have done is when they asked us to, you know, say goodbye on three, we should have all said Enya, but...
So depressing.
Can't win them all.
Nope. We can try to make it up to people now, but that's it.
Yeah.
Want to say bye on three?
I mean, we could also say Effectively Enya.
One, two, three. Craig.
Enya. Oh.
Welcome back to episode 47 of Tino. I hope you used that break to determine how you would reference Enya the next time you are on Effectively Wild. So now we are going to harken back to a series that you will be familiar with if you were with us listening to Tino last year, and that is our division-by-division under-25 Dynasty League rankings that Craig Goldstein and I compile and then debate on Dynasty Dynamics. So basically, we go through on a division-by-division basis and take a look at every player who is 25 up to April 1st of this year, and we rank them sequentially, starting at 1, going all the way to 30. So this year, we started with the NL East, definitely a power-packed division for this type of ranking system. So Brett and Mao, you have access to the lists that Craig and I have created, and I will let you steer the remainder of this segment of our podcast.
All right. So I will go first here. The two names at the top, I don't think surprise anyone. It's Giancarlo Stanton and Bryce Harper in that order. I would tend to agree with that order, although they're very, very close for me. So let's talk about number three, Craig. A little surprised to see you have Christian Yelich above Anthony Rendon here. Why is that? And is this something that is injury related in the near term? Are they that close that makes a difference?
A little bit, yes. So the reason for that is, and I view them, the two of them, Yelich and Rendon, as almost entirely similar players, with the edge to Rendon for positional eligibility and scarcity. But the issue to me is that this is like, it's not only the injury in the short term, but it's his long term. The knee injury is just another in what's become kind of a litany of injuries for the guy in terms of ankle injuries. And so now it's at the point where I'm concerned long-term how he's going to hold up. And I think there will be years where he clears Yelich's value by a reasonable margin when you factor in the position. But I think if I'm taking the next 10 years of either of these two, I think they're close enough in value that I'll take the consistent force. And I think that's Yelich right now. Obviously, he can get hurt too, but the biggest predictor of injury is past injury. And at this point with Rendon, there are a lot of them. So that's why I had Yelich at third, which, you know, going into this season or going into March before Rendon's injury, I wouldn't have it this way. But it's just enough of a track record for me to have some concern at this point.
Okay, so then back to Ben. You have Rendon over Yelich. So is it not being as concerned about the injury side of it, or is it or do you think this is being slightly lower or higher on either player for your rankings, and how close are they for you?
They're close. I won't say it was a coin toss. For me, 1, 2, 3 were very easy, and Yelich and Fernandez, who I have at 5, was a tougher call. I think they're fairly similar players, sort of like Craig alluded to, especially when it comes to stats, just, you know, in a 5x5 league. Rendon gets a huge bump for me for having infield eligibility. I am somewhat worried about the injuries, but not enough to close that gap for me, especially because I do think Rendon is just a little better at most things overall. So I certainly see where Craig's coming from, and I don't think it's unreasonable, but I'm also pretty comfortable with where I have Rendon. I'm not feeling a strong urge to move him down right now.
Sounds good. So moving a little bit further down here, there's a lot of agreement at the beginning, but I want to talk about one guy who shows up here sort of in the middle of the list on both of yours, but is on the shelf for the 2015 season, and that's Zach Wheeler. If we are looking at a healthy Zach Wheeler instead of a Zach Wheeler who is recovering from Tommy John surgery, How much higher would he be on this list? How would healthy Zach Wheeler compare with Shelby Miller, who you both have higher than actual Zach Wheeler on these lists?
I would have had Wheeler at 9. I have Miller at 8 and Giolito at 9. I would have had Wheeler in between those two if he was healthy. I thought he was ready for a breakout year.
I have Wheeler at 16, and I would have had him at 8, behind Julio Teheran and ahead of Lucas Giolito. That's obviously a substantial jump. I also think he was primed for something of a breakout. I also don't know that he needed to break out. I think he and Shelby are actually really comparable in that sense, if they were both healthy, in that, you know, Miller is really usable as is and has, you know, a year, maybe two, left in, you know, like to move up into. And I think the same could be said for Wheeler. I think he was really good. He was inefficient, but you know, if he was someone that if he could become a little more efficient in his pitch usage and start going, you know, into the seventh innings of most games, without being at 120 pitches, which Terry Collins often let him get to, that he could kind of take it to the next level or maybe even a step beyond that in terms of fantasy, because his stuff was obviously electric. So, I mean, I'd have him up ahead of Giolito, who, as I mentioned, I had at 8.
All right. One of the first guys that there's a bit of a difference here on is Michael Franco, and Franco is 15 on Ben's list and 21 on Craig's list. So Craig, I'm more curious in your opinion here. What do you think 2015 has in store for Franco, and how much do you think we see him at the major league level this year?
I think he probably comes up in June, maybe early July. And I think, you know, when I got to Franco, I was like, ugh, I don't know what to do with Franco. And this, you know, so my ranking kind of reflects that. I think he's got enough power to really matter, especially in that park. I don't know. To me, it's like the sum of the parts is less than the whole for Franco in terms of the package of tools and kind of how it's going to translate to fantasy value. I think he'll be useful, but I don't think he's ever going to, you know, be. I think he's like a second division fantasy player. Like, you know, if you're starting him, you're probably looking to improve upon him, and so that's kind of, I think, reflected in my rankings. But I'm open to an argument on it. I he's just someone I'm not really sure how to play exactly.
Yeah, so it's interesting, and I think we've talked about Franco on this podcast before, so I'll try to keep it brief, but I feel the exact opposite in that I think his skill sets really translates quite well to a 5x5 roto league. I think he's a much better fantasy prospect than he is a real prospect, and my biggest fear is that he won't retain third base eligibility for a long time. I think he will get some time at third base, at least this year, probably even next year. But, you know, if you told me Franco has third base eligibility in the rearview mirror permanently by like 2018, that wouldn't shock me. And that concerns me because he'd be very stretched at first base. But at third base, I mean, I think he can be a fringe second division fantasy starter in terms of walking that line between first and second. And when you look at the rest of the guys on this list behind him, it's even though I have Franco at 15, it's largely comprised of second division fantasy starters or prospects who are still a year or two away, or like middle rotation fantasy starter prospects, which are perhaps the most fungible asset in all of fantasy baseball. So I think part of it is I'm just not in love with the list after Franco. And then part of it seems to be I do think his skills will translate better in leagues, especially in that ballpark, because I legitimately think he has 25 homer power.
All right. So the other guy who I want to get Craig's thoughts particularly on, Craig, you have Kevin Plawecki at number 13. Overall, and unless I'm missing something, I don't believe Ben has him on his list at all.
You're not missing everything.
Okay. What makes you think that Plawecki can be a high contributor to a fantasy team? Because that rating, you know, above some of the players that are above, you know, Michael Taylor, Jose Peraza, Zach Wheeler, Aaron Nola. So that ranking says to me that he can vie for being a top, you know, 5 to 7 catcher in time and relatively quickly. So what do you expect from Plawecki over the next year or two?
Well, I think some of it is that I don't necessarily think a ton of Taylor or Peraza. And so I think that's part of it for me. The other part is that, you know, I think he has the potential to have an above average bat, from a league average standpoint, and then put that behind the plate. And I think he's got a chance to have, I don't know, something in the 15 to maybe 15 to 20 homer type power. And when you put that behind the plate, that's a really valuable package. I don't know that, you know, I think he's got that as a ceiling in terms of power. Maybe something in like the 12 to 18 range is probably more reasonable, but that's still really valuable as a catcher, and it's valuable in like a shallow mixed league type of way. And he's basically ready for the majors this year. I don't know that it will happen with the Mets, but, you know, I think if we were pretending that Travis d'Arnaud was on this list, I think it's a similar spot that he'd be in, and I don't know that Plawecki is really worse as a fantasy prospect than d'Arnaud is right now. And so that's I know it's an aggressive ranking, but I think he's a valuable guy at a relatively scarce position, and well, the time it takes catchers to adjust certainly concerns me. I have real questions about Michael Taylor's ability to adjust, Jose Peraza's ability to do anything aside from run fast. You know, Zach Wheeler is my 16th guy. He's out for a year. And a lot of the next guys are either a little further from the majors or mid-rotation fantasy guys, which, as Ben said, are extremely fungible. So I think it's obviously playing to his ceiling, and there's a huge chance that he could be less than that, and I totally acknowledge that. But the difference between him at 13 and, you know, value in a guy like Henderson Alvarez at 25 is not that big to me. It's just a big grouping in that sense. If that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. So just a natural, really quick follow-up question on Plawecki then. So how many other catching prospects would you take over Plawecki right now in a just in the fantasy sense?
That's a good question. Probably Swihart.
Just Swihart.
I think that's it. Who am I missing? I mean, the next one's probably Alfaro, right?
Well, Brett will say Schwarber, but
yes.
Yeah, he and Schwarber would be really close for me. I would have to think on that one. I would totally be comfortable with Schwarber. I would take Plawecki probably ahead of Alfaro at this point.
Okay.
Either second or third for in catcher ranking.
All right. That's certainly aggressive.
It is. But I think he can hit, and I think he's ready now, in my opinion. And, I think there's a lot of value in not waiting on something like that. I think people tend to overlook him, and he's never not hit. And so I think he will.
I completely agree with that point that people do overlook him. Now I'm really curious to get Ben's thought on that same question. So you don't have Plawecki on this list at all, but where would he fall on your fantasy catcher spectrum right now?
Yeah, I didn't think I disliked Plawecki. He made the back end of my top 100 fantasy prospects list. This isn't supposed to denigrate Craig's opinion. I just don't think I've heard anyone be as high on Plawecki as I just heard Craig. I would definitely take Swihart over him. I would definitely take Schwarber over him, even though I don't love Schwarber. I would take Alfaro over him still, although I think that gap has closed some over the last few months for me. I had Plawecki and Andrew Susick back to back, I think, in somewhere in like the high 90s, low 90s rather. It's not a great time for catching prospects in general, which is part of it, and I think part of it is also, you know, Plawecki is sort of a pop-up fantasy prospect, so perhaps I'm not giving him quite enough credit, but he wasn't super close to making this list for me. He probably would have made it if it went down to 40, but I don't think he was in my next one or two players.
Just for what it's worth, and I understand it wasn't a challenge, but the Fangraphs top 200 had Plawecki as the second overall catcher, and I understand that's not fantasy. But he was the 40th overall prospect there. and the second overall catcher behind Swihart. So I'm not alone in my craziness, I should say.
You're never alone when you're with Kevin Pilecki.
That's a nice tagline.
Oddly comforting.
So I don't know how many other questions I really have on this. Did you guys both rank Henderson Alvarez before his latest injury?
After.
After. Okay.
We both ranked Henderson Alvarez within the last 12 hours.
Sounds good. And just one final question. On a scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are either of you that you are going to look very, very low on Steven Matz about a year from now?
I'm going to let Ben go first.
Not that concerned. He seems, I think I would be able to justify his placement by the names that immediately surround him. I think he is a mid-rotation fantasy starter with a shoddy injury history in a good park. So when you balance all those factors, he's with a bunch of other mid-rotation pitching prospects who have some attributes in their favor and some against.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And when you add in, I mean, I will say I've definitely harped on his injury history before. He's been healthy for about 2 years, which definitely, you know, assuages some concern in that front. But I don't know. I think he's more middle of the road in terms of fantasy than anything else. And he could play up in real life, but I just don't see it being that big a change. And I think there's a lot more. I mean, I think obviously there are a lot of people, and I'm assuming, Brett, that you're one of them, who are wrapped up in his upside. But I think there's a lot more downside than people seem willing to give credit on. And so that's kind of why I have him where I do.
Yeah, and like, Craig, a point you made earlier that I think is very fair is that he's in sort of this large group of players that are very similar to me. So, yes, I have Matz down at 26, and that might look really low. But if you tell me you want him at, you know, 20 right behind Matt Wisler, okay, I'm not going to put up a huge fight there. This is all a very similar tier to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I have him at 20. I would say if you wanted to put him above Zach Wheeler, who I have at 16, yeah, that's fine. I mean, he could potentially contribute before Wheeler, and probably is expected to contribute before Wheeler at this point. And that's fine. I mean, Brett, if I had him at 16 or even above Peraza at 15, would you say that's more in line with where you'd have him, or where would you have him?
I'd have him right in that 15 to 17 range.
Okay.
I both agree and disagree with some of the sentiment at the same time. I think Matz kind of gets not by you guys, but Matz kind of lazily gets lumped in as just a kind of a boring mid rotation guy. But he's certainly more risk reward than that. I think Matz does have a legitimate number two starter ceiling. I also think there's certainly injury issues that we all need to be aware of. He's pitched very little for a 2009 draft pick, but I think there's more. I think there's more variance there, but I think the upside would put him up in that range. I mean, I'd have him above Aaron Nola. I don't think I would have him above Zach Wheeler. But just right in that range, I think is a comfortable spot for me.
Yeah, see, Nola is like the line where I draw it. I would have Nola ahead of him in pretty much every situation. I think, you know, just on what I know about him, which is probably less than what you know about him, Brett. I think there's a chance he's a number two starter in real life. I don't think he's going to be that necessarily in fantasy. And well, he's missed bats, you know, he missed bats all last year. It is, you know, he's only thrown basically half a season at AA. His fastball is straight a lot of the times. And I think once you're in the upper minors or in the majors, you know, guys are going to, that's something that kind of doesn't necessarily show itself as a real problem until you reach, you know, the pinnacle of talent. And I think, you know, with a straight fastball, you really have to be pinpoint for major leaguers to hit it or to not hit it. And that's a concern I have. And if he does that, you know, I'll admit to being wrong and that, you know, it's a situation that would, it's something that would change the situation, obviously, but it's a doubt I'm going to carry basically until he proves that's not the case.
Yeah. And to sort of just defend the lumping him in with mid rotation starters quip, like, yeah, I totally get what you're saying that he has more upside than a mid rotation starter, but most fantasy mid rotation prospect starters do have an upside greater than a mid rotation starter. Not all of them, certainly. I mean, like, for example, AJ Cole is near him, and I wouldn't argue he has a number two. He's more along, you know, the line of someone who just looks like a pretty safe bet to be a four, could be a three. But there are there's a pretty all-encompassing group of, you know, quote-unquote mid-rotation fantasy starters who, of course, have that, you know, number two, number four variance. So I don't really think it's unfair to lump Mats in with that group. I guess with the useful caveat that, you know, the number two upside starter is real with him.
All right. That's a lot of Steven Matz talk for one episode. I'm hopeful that we'll actually get to see him this year because he's certainly someone who I think a lot of people are going to be paying close attention to as sort of someone who generates a little bit of excitement over the first half. So I don't have anything I really wanted to touch on besides that on the list. So I'm going to throw it over to Mao, see if there's anything you want to bring up here.
For brevity's sake, I'm going to keep these pretty choppy here. Ben, what's the separator for you between Shelby Miller and Alex Wood? You have him at 8, and you have Miller at 8, and you have Alex Wood at 12.
So not a huge separator to begin with. Not a huge fan of Wood's delivery, and I've always been totally gaga for Shelby Miller.
Craig, you have Roman Quinn at 22. What are the odds that he ends up shooting up this list, given his performance this year? What does he have to do this year to really, you know, kind of start climbing into that top 20?
I think if he hits for average, he'll be there. I mean, he's basically, you know, his speed is, you don't want to say game changing, but he's if he could like assuredly hit for average, you'd put him at least at what Ben, you know, kind of what Ben Revere is, or in the D Gordon range or something like that. Like, he has the ability to steal 60 bases based on speed alone. And so if he could hit for average, he suddenly becomes a multi-category contributor. There's a lot of risk in my placement here, but it's kind of a hedge that if he does hit, he could justifiably, like, I have Jose Peraza at 15 and no one really blinks at that, but he could easily be worth well more than Peraza if Peraza is just a slap hitter who steals, you know, 20 bases a year versus Quinn, who, you know, if they hit for the same average, I think Quinn could steal a bunch more bases, or if Quinn could hit a little better, obviously it makes him a lot more valuable. So it's a little bit of a hedge bet. And my guess is I'm going to either be very wrong or like I'm going to be wrong either way. I'm just either going to be wrong because I underranked him or wrong because I overranked him.
This question is for the both of you. I guess we could start with Ben first. Ben, you ranked Ken Giles at 27. Craig, you ranked him at 23. How much does that have to do with him just being a reliever, being a potential closer, not necessarily having the job yet? And how much is that is weighted? You know, how much helium did you give him for his ability, Ben?
With the caveat that I don't totally understand the question, I will say I think he is a potentially dominant reliever who looks like he's a fairly safe bet to be closing by at least this time this next year, which, okay, pitchers aren't safe and relievers are especially not safe, so perhaps that is a foolhardy statement, but I think if you are looking for a presumptive closer in waiting who has a pretty good shot of closing fairly soon, Giles is the first guy that comes to mind for me, and I think as long as you're not in a 10-team league, he's so good that he could potentially be worth rostering, even if he's not closing, you know, a la a Wade Davis.
Yeah, I considered not ranking Giles, but I have him at 23 because of what Ben just said. He's so good that he could be valuable even without a closing job. And the biggest concern is that relievers lose value in a heartbeat. You know, I mean, neither of us ranked Henry Mejia, and he's eligible to be ranked, but, you know, he doesn't, he's on a suspension and he was a little nicked up. And so, you know, if he doesn't have immediate value and there's no guarantee that he gets the role back on, you know, later on, then he's not worth ranking. I rank Yuris Familia because he has a major league closing gig right now, and that carries value. In terms of long term, Bobby Parnell could have it. Familia could be great and lock it up. Bobby Parnell could be healthy and take it back. There's a huge range of options, and his value swings so wildly based on, you know, whatever happens. So again, this is another kind of hedge where it's like, well, he has a job now and that's worth something. And if I was in a league I was trying to compete in, would I trade injured Henderson Alvarez or in the minors, Mike Foltynewicz for Yuris Familia? I probably would if I needed the saves. So that's kind of how I landed with him there. And I put Giles ahead of him because Giles is so good, but it still just really scares me to rank a reliever who isn't closing.
Okay, and this is going to be another question about the same player directed at the both of you. Craig, why didn't you rank Tyler Kolek, unless I'm missing something?
I did not rank him. Right now he has a fastball and nothing else, and it's a really good fastball, but he's light years away, and it's just not worth it for me to wait. I'd rather all of the guys I've listed, because I think they all have a chance to contribute. Basically, I think everyone I listed is able to contribute in the next 2 years. That wouldn't be like crazy aggressive. And maybe Ronaldo Lopez is too fast for him, who I had at 29, but pretty much everyone else. And I need more than a fastball to buy in.
And Ben, are you worried at all about having Kolek at 24?
Yeah, even just looking at this list, it hasn't gone live yet. I'll probably move him down a little. He'll still be on my top 30. I'm thinking maybe now I'd rather have him at the 27, 28 range. I totally hear what Craig is saying in terms of, the scary thing for me isn't that he fails. The scary thing for me is that he takes so long to fail that I essentially waste a roster spot for 3 or 4 years. So I totally get that concern, but I do think we have to recognize that the upside here is, what, the third highest on this list of any prospect, maybe something in that vicinity. So, I'm comfortable with him at the back end of this list. I probably will move him down a little bit.
Okay, those are all the questions I had.
I have one last question. He's been a source of agita for me, personal agita. But how close was Michael Conforto to making this list for both of you?
Michael Conforto is my one player I wanted to rank higher. He was 31 out of 30 for me. I think we've spent such a long time dwelling on how imperfect he is and how he's not a great fit for Citi Field that we've sort of lost sight on the attractive combination of floor and probability, I suppose, is how I'd phrase that. So he was as close as one can possibly be to making this list for me.
I pretty much agree with everything Ben just said. I forgot he existed when I made my list, and then when I was reminded of it, I kind of thought, I don't really like him that much, so I'm just not going to do it.
Fair enough.
That's scary.
I think I wrote the player that I wanted to rank higher was Eric Fetty for the Nationals. But I said in there, this is actually a really deep, the impact is not necessarily huge after a certain point. It's a really deep division for under 25 players. And so I think Conforto could comfortably fit in above, I think he could fit in right next to Michael Franco on my list, or above Roman Quinn. and could reason, as I did, leave him off the list. So, you know, it's just a really deep group of players in that sense.
Yeah, I had trouble. Basically, after I got past Michael Taylor at 17, I had a shruggy face.
That makes sense. All right, just picking off the top of my head, I imagine I probably would have had him in the 20 range. As much as I begrudge Sandy Alderson for making that pick, I think he's a pretty solidly safe fantasy option across the board.
Brett, where would you have Dom Smith on this list?
He'd be on the list, unlike you bastards.
So if I'm to understand this correctly, you, Brett Sayer, are higher on Mets players than Craig and I are.
Not Plawacki.
That's no, true. Not Plawacki. Well,
and not Ahmed Rosario either.
Yes, I'm so high on Rosario at 30.
Yes. Yes. So yes, I love all Mets players equally.
This like cheap shot brought to you by effectively wild guest Ben Carson. All right, I think that that wraps it up. But Brett, lucky you, we get to stick with you as the essentially, I guess, the host of the second portion of the podcast, because I have no idea what the hell you want to talk about now.
Well, for those of you that can't see at home, we do have a tracking spreadsheet, and this part of the program is just called Brett's Stupid Topic or whatever. So that means I get to talk, and no one can stop me. The thing that I want to talk about just briefly is thinking about early season Dynasty League roster moves. And sort of what we, what sort of time frame you give the lowest members of your roster for different reasons. You know, you think about it in just a pure redraft context, and there have been a lot of people with different philosophies. You get one of the more popular philosophies is, you essentially barring an injury or something overly drastic, you give a player on your roster the inverse of when you took him or what round you took him in. So if you took him in the last round, you give him a week. If you took him in the second to last round, you give him 2 weeks, and you kind of work backwards from there. That's a theory that's relatively popular. I think it's fair as a very simple method. But in Dynasty Leagues, you have a lot more complicated decisions, because the biggest reason is that people want to be the first guys on any pop-up prospects or on guys who look like they're taking legitimate step forward. So the question that I have for you guys, and I'll start with Ben. If you are staring at a free agent minor leaguer who is coming out of the gate like gangbusters, let's use a real example. Say you believe that Blake Snell is putting it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is.
How quickly do you move on him, and what do you look for in a player on your roster to remove in order to pick someone like that up?
So this is, give me a second. This is going to start broad, but I'm pretty sure I can get there. I think this question really speaks to how willing you should be to trade prospects, because there is always a Blake Snell starting out hot that you can pick up. So frequently my Dynasty League rosters end up with one or two minor leaguers who just aren't very good. Pretty sure I kept Chesler Cuthbert in TDGX. And yeah, that looks really funny at the time. But the reason is I spent all my prospects to trade for Carlos Gonzalez. And, you know, okay, I have Chesler Cuthbert. But now if I'm looking at Blake Snell and thinking, I recognize that name because I occasionally read Craig, I'm totally free to go pick him up. So I think it's just another reason that you shouldn't be super, super conservative about trading non-star fantasy prospects. there is always a Blake Snell there for you, and isn't that just comforting?
It is comforting.
Did I not get there? Is that what the silence means? Am I missing something?
No, it works for me. So what? Let's kind of throw it over to Mal. There slightly same question, but a little bit of a different angle to it. How long do you give a player who you think is breaking out a chance to prove it before you make a plunge and grab him and get rid of someone who you clearly liked because you were rostering them?
It depends on the depth of the league. Like, if we're talking about a 12-team dynasty league, then I wait a little bit longer than I would in, say, like a 20-team league. Because as Ben just iterated, like, at that point, you're rostering guys like Chesley Cuthbert, or just names that you kind of recognize, and I'm a little bit quicker on the trigger to replace pretty much organizational depth for someone that I believe to be breaking out. Now, for me, the definition for believing to be breaking out is, you know, it's a pretty strict definition for me. And if I believe that a player is really arriving on the scene, then I'm pretty strong in that conviction. And I'm not, you know, this isn't just like a hair trigger move for me. Like, this is something that I've researched and I've really looked over. So, you know, if I'm going to make a move on that player, this is a player that I've researched for a long time, or, you know, that I've researched, you know, thoroughly as possible, given the resources that are available to me. And I'm not going to be afraid to pull the trigger on that type of guy, especially in a deeper league. And a little bit in a shallower league where the minor league prospects or the rosters that you have are a little bit, you know, more shallower and the dynamic is a little bit different. You know, I'll think about it a little bit harder. But ultimately, if this is a guy that I really believe in, then yeah, I mean, I'm going to go for it.
Craig, do you have any thoughts on this subject in general?
I tend to be rather slow to actually make a move, although I kind of keep tabs on a lot of guys. And I generally, you know, when someone's breaking out, kind of speaking to what Ben was saying, that there's always a Blake Snell, there's kind of always another guy who's interesting on the same level. And so if I don't get, you know, the flavor of the week, I'll go get the flavor of the next week, and that's okay. Mostly I would kind of say it's a cop out, and it would depend on who you're dropping and why. You know, I understand, you know, last picks are last picks, except that, you know, in a 14 team league, your last pick might have been, you know, Anthony Ghost, and then you're talking about your second to last pick, and that might be someone interesting too. And, you know, ultimately you're talking about a guy who's broken out for a week or two in high A, and is that really worth the swap? You know, maybe, but maybe not. And so I kind of wait, you know, like we said, don't overreact to early stuff. You know, at the beginning we said don't overreact. We kind of really take stuff seriously at, you know, maybe a month or two in. I would say the same thing for prospects for the most part, unless it's building on top of something that kind of started to break out the last year. You know, if someone started to make a change in August of last year, you know, maybe they changed their mechanics or they changed their swing and then they started getting results with it, but no one really was sure what to do with it over the off season, and they're hitting the crap out of the ball early this year, then yeah, okay, fine, make a switch. Is that enough of a non-answer to get me to stop talking?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Definitely.
Good.
Yeah, that's really all I wanted to talk about, just because we have some examples already, but we're going to have more and more examples of prospects that are going to start really strong, and dynasty owners, especially ones with deeper farm teams, are going to get that urge that they just can't live without picking up these players. So I think it's important to at least talk about what a reasonable time frame is and sort of what we should be looking for, not to try to piggyback too much off of what we talked about on Effectively Wild yesterday, but it's breakout season. That's where we are.
Yeah, and also, you know, if you're listening to us and you're playing in Dynasty Leagues and you read Baseball Prospectus, like you have a pretty decent idea of like what a real breakout player is, or at least a player that has the opportunity to at least have some upside or some fantasy upside for you, as opposed to a guy like Blake Snell. So I mean, you know, just take that into consideration as well, that it's pretty rare to have the guy who just comes out of nowhere, literally, and appears and really helps your fantasy team in relatively short order. So, you know, just take that into consideration. Also realize that, you know, these things and these breakout players that we will be talking about tend to have a little bit of more information behind them than just 1 week of stats.
Fair enough. So I will, even though I never got the keys in the first place, I will hand the keys back over to Ben.
So you're handing me the keys so that I can say Enya?
Pretty much, yeah. Isn't that how it works? We're rusty.
Enya.
Ben.
Welcome back to episode 47 of Tino. As always, we'll send you out with a little housekeeping. First, we have a brief announcement. Moving forward, Tino will be on an official bi-weekly basis. You may view this as a disappointment, sure, but really, this will not be any different from when we were trying to stick to a weekly schedule and just made excuses. Please rate and review us on iTunes or on any other platform you're using to listen to this podcast. We've had a bunch of good reviews lately, but the more the merrier, and getting to 100 before the season is over would be great. You can follow us on Twitter at Tino Podcast, like our Facebook page, or get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Brett on Twitter at Dynasty Guru. You can find Mauricio at mrubio52. You can find Craig at CD. That's CD as in Confounded Power Rankings Defender, Goldstein. And you can find me at Ben Carsley. Thank you for listening and have a good night.
Would you rather be from Florida or some really poor Central America?
Florida. Wait, do I get a tan from
either be from Florida or some really poor Central American country?
Florida.
Wait, do I get a tan from being from the Central American country, or am I me now in that country?
No, you would have the tan.
I value a tan pretty highly.
It's a tough decision at that point.
You can't get a tan in Florida?
Yeah, but then you're
it's
from
a bad
Florida.
Tan. That's a bad tan, too. The Florida tan, it's not a good tan.
Yeah, that's not a thing.
A redneck.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a thing. It's, Northern Panhandle Florida tan, that's not a good tan.
It's the same. It's the same sun.
Not the same people. Not the same people.
But you're the same person in this scenario.
No, you're not.
I just asked if I was.
That's exactly what Craig asked.
It was specifically my question.
Oh, I thought you meant could you get tan?
No, I'm saying would I have the tan of the native people?
Basically, you want to change your race.
Yes.
Not that I totally blame you, but. So would you rather be a white person in Florida or a native Central American human? Can I be well off in one of those countries, or am I like, oh God, no?
No, you're dirt poor.
Yeah, no, I'm going to Florida.
But you got the tan.
Yeah, I'll deal with the stereotypes to have access to nice things. I can drive away from Florida with the money I have.
People have tried that, and the Florida never really leaves.
That's not always
You always take the Florida with you.
It takes a while, but you can get rid of it.
Ooh, I don't know.
It's tough.
Isn't Jeff Moore
Florida's basically Texas in this sense?
Yeah. Jeff Moore's a... No, he's a transplant. I think he's from Baltimore.
Or like Philly, he's from Delaware. His family went from Delaware.
Shit, like my only defense was Jeff Moore's not so bad. All right, send me to Guatemala.